This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our program. We're reading from Ernest Gaines' novel, A Lesson Before Dying. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and will be made available in podcast after the broadcast. We're pleased to present these dramatic readings of A Lesson Before Dying using a cast of volunteer readers. Feel free to call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
I was sure they were paying closer attention to everything now, and they would not have understood my reason for leaving earlier than I usually did. So I just stood there until the deputy came to let me out. Paul wanted to know how everything had gone between Jefferson and me, and I told him it was better than ever. He looked at me as if he felt I was making all this up, but I could see in his face that he wanted to believe it. I told him that I had promised Jefferson a radio, and that I would go home and get the money to buy one. I would get it from Edwin's department store, and then leave it here for one of them to take to Jefferson, so that he would have music over the weekend. Paul thought it was a good idea, and he promised to give the radio to Jefferson himself. I didn't go home. I thought I would borrow the money from Vivian, and I went back to town, to the Rainbow Club, to wait until she got out of class. The bar was in semi-darkness as usual, with the usual two or three old men talking more than drinking, and Claiborne behind the bar talking with them. I ordered a beer and told Claiborne about the radio. He didn't charge me for the beer, and he went back down the bar and spoke to the old men. Then he came back with a couple of dollar bills and some change. He took $5 out of an old leather wallet that had once been light brown but had almost turned black over the many years that had gone in and out of Claiborne's back pocket. "Thanks," I said. "I'll get it back to you sometime this weekend." The muscle in his left jaw moved a little to show that he had smiled. Then he jerked his head toward the wall, a sign that I should go around the other side and see what I could get in there. So after finishing the beer, I went through the side door into the cafe. It was much more brightly lit than the bar, warmer, and you could smell the food from the kitchen. A man and woman ate at one of the tables. Another man sat eating alone at the counter, and Thelma behind the counter, near the cash register. "Well, well, look what the cat dragged in," she said. I had been at the Rainbow quite a few times lately, but I had not eaten in the cafe. I told Thelma about the radio, and I told her that Claiborne had donated something. She listened patiently, and I could see her face changing from patience to sadness to anger. Her mouth tightened as she looked around the room at her three customers, then back at me again. The anger had left. "You hungry?" she asked. It was stern but loving, too. "No, I ate before I came," I told her. She didn't believe me. "I got some smothered steaks there," she said. "Shrimps, chicken." "I'm not hungry." "You want to go get that radio now?" "I would like to get it this afternoon." "How much they cost?" "About $20. "Eat something. I'll make up the rest," she said. She went back into the kitchen and dished up some rice and beefsteak and sweet peas, and she added a little lettuce and tomato salad and a couple of slices of light bread. "How much more you need?" she asked, after she had set the food down before me. "About $10, I said. "But listen, Thelma, I can borrow some of that money from Vivian." "Vivian got them children," she said. "I can let you just have it." "I'll bring it back tomorrow." "I ain't in no hurry." I ate the food hungrily because I had not had dinner, and I sopped up the gravy with the light bread. Thelma watched me all the time. When I was finished, she put a wrinkled $10 bill on the counter by my plate. "Here." It was the kind of "here" your mother or your big sister or your great aunt or your grandmother would have said. It was the kind of "here" that let you know that this was hard-earned money, but also that you needed it more than she did. The kind of "here" that said she wished you had it and didn't have to borrow it from her, but since you did not have it, and she did, then here it was, with a kind of love. It was the kind of here that asked the question, when will all this end? When will a man not have to struggle to have money to get what he needs here? When will a man be able to live without having to kill another man here? I took the money without looking at her. I didn't say thanks. I knew she didn't want to hear it. I went out to my car and drove back uptown. Edwin's was not the best store in town, but it was the place where most people bought what they needed. Those with money went either to Morgan's department store or to Baton Rouge in New Orleans. As you came into the store, you saw clothes for women on the left and clothes for men on the right, all set out neatly. There were no other customers and just one saleswoman, who did not show much interest in me. I went to the back of the store, passing the furniture department with its chairs, couches, beds, chiffer robes, dressers, then the refrigerators and ice boxes, gas and wood-burning stoves, washing machines. Then there was the garden and yard equipment, hoes, rakes, shovels, axe handles, mowing machines, yo-yo blades, cane knives, and at the very end of the store were the radios and kitchen appliances on shelves against the wall. I saw the little radio that I had in mind, and I took it down from the shelf to look at it more closely and feel its weight. Then I set it back on the shelf and turned on the knob, and after warming up for a few seconds, it started playing. I moved the lighted dial to get to another station. I could only find three, two in Baton Rouge and one in New Orleans. But that was normal for this time of day. At night, you were able to tune into others. You could get one as far west as Del Rio, Texas, and another as far east as Nashville. I was still listening to one of the Baton Rouge stations when the saleswoman came up behind me. "You gonna buy that?" I looked around at the short, stout, powdered-faced white woman. "Yes, ma'am." Her face changed, but only a little. "How much is it?" I asked. $20 plus tax. "Do you have one in a box?" "That one's brand new," she said. Her face was getting hard again. "It's a present," I said. "I would like one in a box." "I can put this one in a box," she said. "No, ma'am. I want a brand new one," I said, "if you have one." "You can have this one for a dollar less," she said. "I prefer a brand new one, please, ma'am," I said. She snapped off the radio and turned away. She was gone about 15 minutes. I knew it couldn't possibly take her that long to find another radio, but because I had refused to take the used one, and because she felt quite sure there was no place in Bayonne where I could find another one, she knew I had no choice but to wait until she got back. "Brand new one," she said behind me. "Seal ain't even broke." "Does it have batteries?" I asked her. "It's ready to play," she said. "You want it?" "Yes, ma'am," I said. She started up the aisle toward the cash register. But just then, another white woman came into the store. The clerk set down the radio beside the cash register and went to see what the white woman wanted. The other woman was not buying anything. She only wanted to talk. So they stood there about 10 minutes before the clerk came back to wait on me. After ringing up the bell, she asked me if I needed a bag, but she asked it in a way that I knew she didn't want to give me one. "No thanks," I told her, and after paying, I tucked the little radio under my arm and left. The courthouse was to the right and across the street from the store. I walked between the parked cars and past the statue of the Confederate soldier and the state, national, and Confederate flags. Paul and Sheriff Goodry were in the office. Paul saw the package under my arm, and I could see that he was happy that I had remembered. The sheriff looked up at me from his desk. "Well, Professor, is that the radio?" "Yes, sir, I hope you don't mind." "No, I don't mind this time," he said. "But from now on, you ask permission before you bring anything else in here."
"I spoke to the deputy."
"The deputy can't give you permission to bring things in here. I do," he said. I was quiet. "Leave it," the sheriff said. "I'll see that he gets it. Batteries, I hope?"
"Yes, sir, batteries,"
I said. I almost said batteries.
"How did it go today?" he asked.
"All right," I said. The sheriff nodded. "I'll see that he gets it. Thank you, sir." I looked at Paul. He nodded and smiled. He probably would have said something encouraging if the sheriff hadn't been there. I went to my car and drove back to the Rainbow, hoping Vivian would be there, and that we would have a drink and just sit there in the semi-darkness alone together.
Chapter 23. Miss Emma felt well enough on Monday to accompany my aunt and Reverend Ambrose to visit Jefferson. After the usual search, Paul led them to the day room, then went to the cell for Jefferson. Jefferson asked if he could take the radio. The deputy said no. Jefferson said he wouldn't go. I would hear later that Jefferson had not turned the radio off since Paul brought it to him on Friday evening. The other prisoners could hear the radio at all times of the day and night. No one else had a radio, and the prisoners wished he would play it louder, but no one would dare say anything to him. The prisoners nearest his cell could faintly hear the music he played, but the ones farther away could only hear static, though he searched day and night for stronger stations. "You want me to bring them here?" Paul asked Jefferson. Jefferson went on listening to the radio without answering him. The deputy returned to the day room and told Miss Emma what had happened. She had already set the table, and she and my aunt and Reverend Ambrose had taken their places, leaving a space for Jefferson. The food, beef stew and Irish potatoes, was still in the pot and covered. A tablespoon and a paper napkin lay beside each tin pan on a white tablecloth. "Radio?" Miss Emma asked Paul. "Grant bought him one."
"When?"
"Last Friday."
"That mean he ain't coming?"
"That's what he said," the deputy told her. Miss Emma sat staring at the space where Jefferson was supposed to sit. Then she looked up at Paul again.
"Can we go to him?"
she asked.
"Sure,"
he said, "but it's going to be uncomfortable, y'all trying to eat out of them pans standing up."
"We don't mind,"
Miss Emma said, and pushed herself up from the table. My aunt helped her collect everything. Then the three of them followed the deputy back to the cell. Jefferson lay on his bunk, listening to music on the radio. 45 minutes later, when Paul returned to the cell, he found the radio turned off and Jefferson lying on his side, facing the wall, his back to the people. The deputy opened the door to let them out, and Jefferson turned from the wall and snapped on the radio. Paul told Miss Emma that the sheriff wanted to see her. The sheriff was sitting behind his desk. There were two empty chairs, but he did not ask anyone to sit down.
"He give you any trouble back there?"
the sheriff asked Miss Emma.
"No, sir."
"I said from the start I didn't want any trouble," the sheriff said. "If that radio is causing any trouble, I'll get it out of there."
"It ain't causing no trouble," Miss Emma said.
"He didn't come to the day room."
"We went to him. We managed."
"Standing up?"
"Yes, sir. We didn't mind."
"You minded before," the sheriff said. "That's why you went and worried my wife."
"Yes, sir," Miss Emma said.
"Listen," the sheriff said, pointing a finger across the desk. "He hasn't got much time. I don't want any trouble. Y'all have to work together with that teacher."
"We gon' work together," Miss Emma said. "I'll talk to Grant when I get back."
"What about you, Reverend?" the sheriff asked. "My duty to stand by Sis Emma," Reverend Ambrose said. "And what about Jefferson?" the sheriff asked. "What about his soul?"
According to Paul, who told me this later, Reverend Ambrose lowered his eyes and did not answer.
"All right," the sheriff said. "Y'all work it out your way. Any problems, and I'll take that radio or stop the visits."
Reverend Ambrose came back to the quarter between 2:30 and 3 o'clock, and when I dismissed school, one of the boys came back to tell me that my aunt wanted to see me at Miss Emma's house before I went home. All three of them were sitting around the kitchen table when I came in. They had already finished their coffee. The cups were still on the table, but empty.
"You know what you done?" my aunt asked me.
I could tell by her face and her voice that she was mad.
"What did I do?"
I asked.
"Why?"
"Why what, Tandy Lou?"
"That radio," she said. "That radio!"
"What's wrong with the radio?"
"What's wrong with it?" Reverend Ambrose cut in. "What's wrong with it? That's all he do. Listen to that radio. That's what's wrong with it."
"And what's wrong with that?" I asked.
"He didn't have time to come sit down with us today. That's what's wrong with that," the minister said. "He ain't got time for nothing else. That's what's wrong with that."
"Jefferson needs something in that cell," I said.
"Yes, he do," the minister said. "You hit the nail on the head, mister. Yes, he do, but not that box."
"And what do you suggest, Reverend Ambrose?" I asked.
"God," the minister said. "He ain't got but 5 more Fridays and a half. He needs God in that cell, and not that sin box."
"What sin box?" I said.
"What you call that kind of music he listened to?" the minister asked. us standing in there trying to talk to him and him listen to that thing till she got to reach over and turn it off. What you call it?
I call it company, Reverend Ambrose, I said.
And I call it sin company, he said.
And I don't care what you call it, I said to him.
Grant, my aunt said.
I could see that she was becoming more and more angry with me. Now she got up from her chair.
You don't talk like that, she said. Never.
Louise, Miss Emma called to her. Louise,
I didn't raise you that way, my aunt said, coming toward me.
Louise, please, Lord, don't. Miss Emma pushed up from her chair. My aunt stopped a step or two away from me, though it was clear she wanted to slap me.
We have to get something straight around here, I said, and right now. I don't know a thing about God or sin. What I do know is, my Lord, the minister said, looking at me as if I were the devil himself, listen to the teacher of our children.
Last Friday, I continued, was the first time, the very first time that Jefferson looked at me without hate, without accusing me of putting him in that cell. Last Friday was the first time he ever asked me a question or answered me without accusing me for his condition. I don't know if you all know what I'm talking about. It seems you don't. But I found a way to reach him for the first time. Now, he needs that radio, and he wants it. He wants something of his own before he dies. He wants a gallon of ice cream for his last supper. Did he tell you that? Did he tell you he never had enough ice cream? Did he tell you he never had a radio of his own before? Did he tell you any of this? He wants those things before he dies. He has only a month to live, and all I'm trying to do is make it as comfortable as I can for him.
And after that radio and that ice cream, how about his soul, mister? My aunt asked me.
I don't know a thing about the soul, I said.
Yes, you do,
she said. She tightened her mouth. She wanted to cry, and she wanted to slap me. Not only for this moment, but for all those years that I had refused to go to her church.
Yes, you do, she said, shaking her head, because I raised you better.
And you sent me to him, Tanty Lou, I said. And I'm only trying to reach him the best way I can.
Turning him against God?
Tanty Lou, that radio has nothing to do with turning Jefferson against God, I said. That radio is there to help him not think about death. He's locked up in that cage like an animal, and what else can he think about but that last day and that last hour? That radio makes it less painful. Now, if you all want that radio out of there, you just go on and take it from him. But I won't go back up there anymore.
We got to have it your way or else.
That's it? Reverend Ambrose cut in. No, I said, you can have it your way. You can take it from him. But you won't reach him if you do. The only thing that keeps him from thinking he is not a hog is that radio. Take that radio away and let's see what you can do for the soul of a hog.
Then I'm the one that's not needed, the minister said.
No, Miss Emma said, you have to go, Reverend Ambrose. I'll make him see.
You saw today how it was, the minister said. He can't hear me through that wall of sin.
I'll make him see, Miss Emma said. He needs you. Maybe he don't know it yet, but he needs you.
Maybe you don't know it yet either, Grant.
All I know, Miss Emma, is that last Friday was the first time I reached him, I said. It was the first time he didn't call himself a hog.
And that whole gallon of ice cream?
The minister said.
You sure you reached him?
I didn't know how to answer that.
Well, Mr. Teacher,
Reverend Ambrose said, I'm waiting for your answer. My aunt and Miss Emma were also waiting. I went back to see Jefferson again on Wednesday. On Tuesday, I had asked the children at the school to bring large pecans and roasted peanuts for me to take to him. Some brought pecans in paper bags. Some brought them in little flour and rice sacks. Others brought them in their pockets. There were about 25 pounds of pecans, about half that many pounds of roasted peanuts. I took a few pounds of each and left the rest to be distributed among the children after school. In Bayonne, I bought a half dozen apples, some candy, and two or three comic books. You did not hear the music until you got near the cell. He was lying on his bunk, the little radio on the floor at his head. Paul let me in and left. How's it going, partner? I said. The children sent you some pecans and peanuts. I bought you some apples and a couple candy bars, some funny books. He let his feet slide to the floor as he sat up on the bunk. I stood there a while. Then I sat down at the foot of the bunk and handed him the bag. He took it without saying anything and set it on the floor. The radio was still playing. "Doing all right?" I asked him. He sat there staring at the wall in front of him, his big hands clasped together. He nodded his head. "How's the radio?" I asked him. "All right." "Did you get Randy over the weekend?" "Yeah, I caught him." "I listened to him a little bit myself," I said. "You didn't have any trouble getting the station, did you?" "No, I got him all right," he said. We were quiet. He stared at the concrete wall. The radio was playing Western music on a station out of Baton Rouge. "You want to ask me anything?" He shook his head. I waited a moment until I thought it was a good time to speak. "I saw your Nanan the other day after she came back from seeing you, Jefferson. She said you didn't have dinner with them in the day room. They had to come here, and they couldn't sit down." He didn't say anything. "When they come back, can you meet them in there, Jefferson? She needs that." "All right." "You'll do it for me? For her?" I asked. "All right." "She would love that, Jefferson. And Reverend Ambrose, will you let him talk to you?" "All right." I didn't know anything else to talk about, and he had nothing to say, so we just sat there quietly a while. "Jefferson," I said finally, "I want to be your friend. I want you to ask me questions. I want you to say anything that comes to your mind, anything you want to say to me. I don't care what it is, say it. I'll keep it to myself if you want. I'll talk about it to other people if you want. Will you do that for me?" He nodded his head. He was staring at the wall. "I just thought of something," I said. "Sometimes at night, sometimes when you're thinking about something and may not be able to remember it when I come back, I was just thinking maybe I could bring you a little notebook and a pencil. You could write your thoughts down, and we could talk about it when I came back. Or maybe you could talk to Reverend Ambrose about it when he came to visit you. Would you like that?" "All right." "You want me to bring it?" "If you want." "And you would write down your thoughts? Anything you want to talk about?" He nodded his head, but he was still looking at the wall. "Do you believe I'm your friend, Jefferson?" I asked him. "Do you believe I care about you?" He didn't answer. "Jefferson?" But he was not listening. I looked around the cell, at the seatless brown-stained commode, the washbowl whose faucet never stopped dripping, the little metal shelf over the bowl, which held his pan, tin cup, and spoon. Through the barred window, I could see the branches of the sycamore tree stirring from a soft breeze. There was still a chill in the air, and Jefferson wore one of my heavy wool shirts. On the floor, the little radio had been playing one Western song after another. "You like that country stuff, huh?" "It don't matter." "Me, I go for Randy," I said. "I like those low-down blues." I heard someone opening the big steel door at the other end of the cell block. As he came down the aisle, I could hear Paul speaking to the prisoners. "Well, I guess I'll be taken off," I said. "Anything you want me to tell your Nanan?" I had stood. Now he looked up at me. There was no hate in his face, but Lord, there was pain. I could see that he wanted to say something, but it was hard for him to do. I stood over him, waiting.
Tell the cheer and thank you for the pecans," he stammered.
I caught myself grinning like a fool. I wanted to throw my arms around him and hug him. I wanted to hug the first person I came to. I felt like someone who had just found religion. I felt like crying with joy. I really did. I held out my hand. He raised his, a big hand, but with no grip. Cool, dead weight. I squeezed his hand with both of mine. I must have had that grin still on my face when Paul opened the door to let me out. "Everything's okay?" he asked. "Yes," I said.
Thank you. Chapter 24. Miss Emma thought we should all visit Jefferson together as often as we could. I wasn't crazy about the idea of being at the courthouse at the same time as the minister, but one look from my aunt, and I decided that I would go along at least once. Leaving Irene Cole and Odessa Freeman in charge of the classes, I drove to Bayonne with a bag of pecans and peanuts. I remembered my promise to Jefferson, so I dropped by the drugstore for a notebook and a pencil. It was a little after 2 when I got to the courthouse. The minister, Miss Emma, and my aunt were waiting for me outside. They stood by the minister's car near the statue of the Confederate soldier and the 3 flags. The flags hung limp beneath the overcast sky. The minister and my aunt looked at me, and both seemed angry, as if I had kept them waiting deliberately. I had not, of course. If I had not stopped for the notebook and pencil, I probably would have arrived there before they did, but I did not explain this to them. Miss Emma did not feel the same as they did, and that was all that mattered. Both she and my aunt carried food baskets covered with dish towels. As I approached them, Miss Emma pushed herself away from the car and started heavily toward the entrance to the courthouse. My aunt and the minister walked behind her, and I followed. Paul was not there, and the chief deputy, after searching the food and us, led us out of the office into the corridor. He walked several paces ahead of us, as we were not with him. I must start that one more time. He walked several paces ahead of us, as if we were not with him. When we came to the restroom marked White Men, he went inside. We waited for him along the wall. 5 minutes later, he came out with another white man. They stood there talking another minute or two before he continued along the corridor. We went up the steps and into the day room, and without a word, he opened the door and left us. Miss Emma and my aunt spread out a tablecloth on the table. Then they placed a pan, a spoon, and a paper napkin in 5 places. After they had set up everything, they and the minister sat down, but I remained standing. The first thing you heard were the chains around his ankles. Then Jefferson entered the room through the rear door, followed by the deputy. Jefferson wore the same brown wool shirt he'd had on a couple of days before. He had on a pair of faded denims and brogans with no laces. He was dragging his feet to keep the shoes on. "Here he is," the deputy said. "See y'all at 3. "Paul's not here today?" I asked. "Mr. Paul's got other duties," the deputy said. He looked at me as if to remind me that I was supposed to say Mr. before a white man's name. He stood there eyeing me until he felt that I understood. "I brought you some good old gumbo," Miss Emma said to Jefferson. "How's it going, partner?" I said as I took my seat beside him. "All right," he said. "The radio still playing?" He nodded his head. "Good," I said. Miss Emma put rice in each pan. Then she poured gumbo over the rice until the pan was nearly full. Besides shrimps, she had put in smoked sausage and chicken in the gumbo, and she had seasoned it well with green onion, filet, and black pepper. Gumbo was something you could always eat, even if you were not hungry. I started in, but I was the only one, and I soon realized why. "May we bow our heads," the minister said after I had put down my spoon. Jefferson's head had been bowed from the moment he sat down. I lowered my eyes. "Our Father who art in heaven," Reverend Ambrose began. He went through the Lord's Prayer, but that was only for warming up. Then he really got down to praying. He asked God to come down to Bayonne, into the courthouse, into the jail, walk along the cell block, go into each cell, touch each heart, come into this room and touch the hearts of those here who did not know him in the pardon of their sins. As he prayed, the minister would slump closer and closer to the table. Then he would jerk his head up and gaze at the ceiling. Miss Emma and my aunt responded with, "Amen, amen, amen," but Jefferson was quiet, and so was I. Whether or not he was listening, I don't know, but all I was thinking about was the gumbo getting cold. Finally, Reverend Ambrose brought his prayer sermon to an end, begging God to bless the gift on the table, which was there to nourish our bodies, so that we might do his bidding. Everyone responded with amen, except Jefferson. I started eating. The gumbo was warm, but not hot. "Ain't you goin' eat, Jefferson?" Miss Emma said. "Ain't hungry," Miss Emma was not eating either, but the minister and my aunt and I were, and I broke off a piece of bread from one of the loaves that Miss Emma had baked. I didn't look at her. I didn't want to see her face. "The children sent you some more pecans and peanuts," I said to Jefferson. "Did you eat the others I brought you?" "Some," he said. "The peanuts, too?" "Few," he said, his head down. "I brought you that notebook and that pencil," I said. "Do you remember what we talked about?" He nodded shortly. "Have you been thinking of questions to ask me?" He nodded again. "Do you want to ask me now?" He didn't say anything. I finished my pan of gumbo. "There's more there, Grant," Miss Emma said. "No, ma'am, that was good," I said, glancing at her. I didn't want to look at her too long. I knew what I would find in her face, and I didn't want to see it. "You want to walk?" I said to Jefferson. He moved on the bench without answering. You could hear the chains around his ankles as he swung his legs over the bench. Then he braced his cuffed hands against the table to push himself up. We started walking around the room. Miss Emma watched us. My aunt and the minister went on eating, but they did not seem to be enjoying their food. "Jefferson, I want us to be friends," I said. "Not only you and me, but I want you to be friends with your Nan-Nan. I want you to be more than a godson to her. A godson obeys, but a friend, well, a friend would do anything to please a friend." We were passing by the table, so I lowered my voice. Jefferson shuffled along beside me, his cuffed hands hanging below his waist, his shoulders too close together, his head down. "A friend does a lot of little things," I went on. "It would mean so much to her if you would eat some of the gumbo." I stopped when we came to the corner of the room. He stopped too, his head still down. "Look at me, Jefferson, please," I said. He raised his head slowly. I smiled at him. "Will you be her friend? Will you eat some of the gumbo? Just a little bit. One spoonful." He made a slight nod. I smiled at him again. "Jefferson," I said, we had started walking. "Do you know what a hero is, Jefferson? A hero is someone who does something for other people. He does something that other men don't and can't do. He is different from other men. He is above other men. No matter who those other men are, the hero, no matter who he is above them." I lowered my voice again until we had passed the table. "I could never be a hero. I teach, but I don't like teaching. I teach because it is the only thing an educated black man can do in the South today. I don't like it. I hate it. I don't even like living here. I want to run away. I want to live for myself and for my woman and for nobody else. That is not a hero. A hero does for others. He would do anything for people he loves because he knows it would make their lives better. I am not that kind of person, but I want you to be. You could give something to her, to me, to those children in the quarter. You could give them something that I never could. They expect it from me, but not from you. The white people out there are saying that you don't have it, that you're a hog, not a man, but I know they are wrong. You have the potentials we all have, no matter who we are. Those out there are no better than we are, Jefferson. They are worse. That's why they are always looking for a scapegoat, someone else to blame. I want you to show them the difference between what they think you are and what you can be. To them, you're nothing but another nigger. No dignity, no heart, no love for your people. You can prove them wrong. You can do more than I can ever do. I have always done what they wanted me to do, teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, nothing else, nothing about dignity, nothing about identity, nothing about loving and caring. They never thought we were capable of learning these things. Teach those niggers how to print their names and how to figure on their fingers. And I went along, but hating myself all the time for doing so. We were coming up to the table again, and the ones at the table were quiet and trying to hear what we were saying. I did not start talking again until we had passed them. "Do you know what a myth is, Jefferson?" I asked him. "A myth is an old lie that people believe in. White people believe that they're better than anyone else on earth, and that's a myth. The last thing they ever want is to see a black man stand and think and show that common humanity that is in us all. It would destroy their myth. They would no longer have justification for having made us slaves and keeping us in the condition we are in. As long as none of us stand, they're safe. They're safe with me. They're safe with Reverend Ambrose. I don't want them to feel safe with you anymore. I want you to chip away at that myth by standing. I want you, yes, you, to call them liars. I want you to show them that you are as much a man, more a man than they can ever be. That jury, you call them men? That judge, is he a man? The governor is no better. They play by the rules their forefathers created hundreds of years ago. Their forefathers said that we're only 3/5 human, and they believe it to this day. Sheriff Guidry does, too. He calls me Professor, but he doesn't mean it. He calls Reverend Ambrose Reverend, but he doesn't respect him. When I showed him the notebook and pencil I brought you, he grinned. Do you know why? He believes it was just a waste of time and money. What can a hog do with a pencil and paper? We stopped. His head was down. Look at me, Jefferson, please, I said. He raised his head. He had been crying. He raised his cuffed hands and wiped one eye, then the other. I need you, I told him. I need you much more than you could ever need me. I need to know what to do with my life. I want to run away, but go where and do what? I'm needed here, and I know it, but I feel that all I'm doing here is choking myself. I need someone to tell me what to do. I need you to tell me, to show me. I'm no hero. I can just give something small. That's all I have to offer. It is the only way that we can chip away at that myth. You can be bigger than anyone you have ever met. Please listen to me, because I would not lie to you now. I speak from my heart. You have the chance of being bigger than anyone has ever lived on that plantation or come from this little town. You can do it if you try. You have seen how Mr. Farrell makes a slingshot handle. He starts with just a little piece of rough wood, any little piece of scrap wood. Then he starts cutting, cutting and cutting and cutting, then shaving. Shaves it down clean and smooth till it's not what it was before, but something new and pretty. You know what I'm talking about, because you have seen him do it. You had one that he made from a piece of scrap wood. Yes, yes, I saw you with it. And it came from a piece of old wood that he found in the yard somewhere. And that's all we are, Jefferson. All of us on this earth, a piece of drifting wood, until we, each one of us individually, decide to become something else. I am still that piece of drifting wood, and those out there are no better. But you can be better, because we need you to be and want you to be. Me, your godmother, the children, and all the rest of them in the quarter. Do you understand what I'm saying to you, Jefferson? Do you? He looked at me in great pain. He may not have understood, but something was touched, something deep down in him, because he was still crying. I cry not from reaching any conclusion by reasoning, but because, lowly as I am still part of the whole. Is that what he was thinking as he looked at me crying? Come on, I said. Let's have some gumbo. And we went back to the table.
Chapter 25. Reverend Ambrose, my aunt, and Miss Emma returned to the quarter, and I went back uptown to the Rainbow Club. The place was in semi-darkness as usual, with three old men at the bar doing more talking than drinking, and only two other people in the place, a couple of mulatto bricklayers sitting at a table. I had come here to tell Vivian that everything had gone well. Jefferson and I were communicating, and he and his nan-nan were also talking. I was feeling very good, and I wanted to tell it to her before I told it to anyone else. How he and I had gone back to the table, how we had eaten the gumbo, though it was cold, and how his nan-nan was so proud. I wanted to tell her that. I did not wish to tell her about the envy I had seen in the minister's face. No, I would not say that the minister felt I was controlling Jefferson's life, and that he, the minister, thought that since Jefferson had only a short time to live, it should be he in control and not I. No, I didn't want to say that to her. I only wanted to talk about things that made me feel good. The look on his nan-nan's face, the look on my aunt's face, the way Jefferson raised a spoonful of gumbo and rice to his mouth with both hands and dipped the spoon again and raised it to his mouth, because I had asked him to do that. And that's what I wanted to talk about how he picked up the bag of pecans and peanuts and the bag with a tablet and pencil when the deputy came to the table to take him back to his cell. And though he did not walk as straight as I wished he would, the fact that he was carrying the notepad and the pencil made up for it. I wanted to talk about that to Vivian, not about the minister or his envy, the way he looked when Jefferson and I had come back to the table. Sure, he was happy to see that Sister Emma was happy, but it was not he who had made her so, and he did not like that. Sin, or the sinner, had done this, not he. I wanted, too, to talk about how Jefferson's nan-nan looked at him as he ate the gumbo she had cooked for him especially, and about how he said goodbye when he had to go. That was what I wanted to talk about. It was near 3:30 when I got to the Rainbow Club, and I had thought that by now Vivian would be there with some of her teaching friends. Since she was not, I thought I would have a drink or two till she showed up. I could hear the mulatto bricklayers talking over in the corner. I was in a very good mood, at least I thought I was, and at first I wasn't paying much attention to what they were saying. I could hear them well enough, but I had no idea that they were speaking for my benefit. I had ordered a bourbon and water from Claiborne, and I was sipping it slowly and thinking about Vivian and about Jefferson. Things have not been going too well for Vivian and me in bed, and I knew it was because of Jefferson and my worrying about him. Between him and school, I was drained of my energy. Vivian knew that too, and she was ready to accept it, much more than I was. She knew how it had been before, and she knew how it would be again, and she told me not to worry about it. But that was not enough for me. I did worry. I didn't think anything in the world was worth us not being able to make it well in bed. Nothing. And that was one of the reasons I had come back here to see her, to tell her that I had finally reached him, and that I would be more relaxed now, and that it was going to be all right between her and me from now on. The two brick-colored bricklayers were still talking over in the corner, and for a long time I didn't pay their conversation any close attention. I heard the word nigger a few times, and I heard the words should have been done long ago, but I never made the connection. After I finished my first drink, I nodded for Claiborne to come down the bar, and now Claiborne heard them too. Maybe they wanted him to hear. Maybe they wanted him to hear so he would say something to me, maybe. But all Claiborne did was serve me another drink, glance at them a couple times, and go back to where the three old men were doing much more talking than drinking. I went on sipping for my second drink and thinking about Vivian and Jefferson. I was wondering what Vivian had worn today and how her hair was combed and how she would look when she came into the place. I was thinking about that. And about Jefferson and what he would write on the notepad, questions or comments. I was wondering what his handwriting would look like, and whether I would have the nerve to question him about anything I did not understand. These are the things I was thinking when the two bricklayers went on talking over in the corner. Down the bar, I saw Claiborne glancing their way again. He could not hear them now, but he had heard them when he was serving me, and he knew I could be listening. There was a tall one and there was a short, fat one. The tall one was doing most of the talking, and I could tell he was angry. Maybe it was over his job. I had seen both of them before without being friendly, and I knew that, like many of the mulattoes in this part of the state, they did bricklaying or carpentry, and possibly some house painting. All this by contract. And all this to keep from working in the field side by side with the niggers. Since emancipation, almost 100 years ago, they would do any kind of work they could find to keep from working side by side in the field with the niggers. They controlled most of the bricklaying business in this part of the state. Even took that kind of work from the white boys because they would do it so much cheaper than the white boys would. Anything not to work alongside the niggers. With school it was the same. Many of them would drop out of school, would get a trade, bricklayer or carpenter, rather than sit in class side by side with the niggers. Their sisters went to high school and college, but they would not. Rather take a trade than to sit next to the niggers. And these two who were talking now were of that way of thinking. dumb as hell, but prejudiced as hell. They had no place to go to do their drinking, and they would not dare to go to any of the white clubs. So they would come here and bring their prejudiced attitude with them. They would keep it down when there were several blacks in the place, but with only me and the three old men standing at the bar today, they felt pretty safe. "Should have burned him months ago," one said. I figured it was a tall one because out of the corner of my eye, I'd seen that he was doing most of the talking. "That kind of son of a bitch make it hard on everybody," he went on. "I'd pull the switch myself," they asked me. I knew now what they were talking about and who they were talking about, but I told myself to keep it cool. Let them talk. They were probably out of work. It was just plain frustration that made them go on like that. Just cool it, I told myself. You just cool it now. But when I looked down the bar, I could see that Claiborne was listening to them too. And even the old men had looked back once or twice. So now we were all hearing them, but I could hear them better because I was closer to their table. And the old forester was not doing anything to keep me from listening. It was helping me listen. That's the way it is with booze. It gives and takes. It keeps you from doing what you're supposed to do well in bed, and other times it makes you listen to things you should not listen to, like now. "Let him talk," I said again to myself. "If you can't stand it here and take it, then get into your car and leave. Go somewhere else and get a drink. He's only got a few more weeks, and you have to do all you can for him, for the others. You came here in a good mood because this was one of the best days you've had with him. You can't let this kind of trash destroy that good feeling, so don't, all right?" I finished the drink and sucked on an ice cube as I rolled the glass around in the palms of my hands. I raised the glass for the last drop before setting it on the bar. I turned around slowly and looked at them, the tall one with the cowboy hat, the short fat one with the baseball cap turned backwards on his head. All I was going to do was lean back against the bar a moment, then I was going to walk out. They knew I was looking at them, and they were quiet a moment. Then the tall one said something, and the fat one snickered, and I thought I had heard enough. I went up to their table. "Shut up." "What?" the tall one said. "You heard me," I said. "Shut up." He grinned at me. "You don't mean that." "You shut up or get up," I said. "I mean that." He looked at his buddy, then back at me. And the hatred in those light brown eyes was thick enough to cut with a cane knife. He grinned. "That's fine with me, partner." He braced himself against the table to stand up. But he was getting up with too much confidence, and I hit him before he had a chance to protect himself, and down he went over the back of that chair. Just as I expected, old fat boy jumped up too, and I caught him in the face with the side of my fist. I saw him fall back and throw his hand up to his mouth. I got my back to the wall so I could keep both of them in front of me. I don't know whether Claiborne came over the bar, under the bar, or around the bar, but he was there now, and he had grabbed the fat one, and he was hollering for me and the other one to cut it out. "Not in here," he was hollering. "Not in here, goddammit." The tall one was up, and he was trying to move in on me, and when I saw that Claiborne had grabbed Fat Boy, I moved away from the wall with my guard up. Claiborne was wrestling with the fat one, but hollering at us. The tall one kept coming in on me. Then he swung, and I moved, and he went into a wall. His back was to me, but I didn't hit him. Not that I'm a gentleman fighter. I didn't hit him because he was between the wall and the table, and if I had moved in close enough to hit him, I would not have had enough room to move around. He came off that wall and he swung at me again, not with fist first, but with both arms at once, just as Frankenstein had done in the movies. He missed. But I could feel the force of his swing, even his body heat, and I knew that if nobody stopped this thing, I was in for a fight. He was taller and heavier and stronger than I, and he had three or four generations of bricklaying genes in him. Well, I had only cane cutting in mind. Out of the corner of my eye, I could still see Claiborne wrestling with the fat one, while continuing to holler at me and the tall one to stop. But since the tall one was not paying any attention to him, I wasn't about to drop my guard. He swung at me again, and I went under his arm and struck him in the side with all I had, but it seemed as if I'd hit a wall. I told myself, "Partner, you got your work cut out for you. He doesn't know how to fight, but he's strong as a mule." He came back, and this time he landed, not his fist, his arm. And I thought it was chicken shit of him to hit me with an arm and not a fist as a man should hit a man, but I was thinking this from the floor. I don't know what was going on in his mind, but he was standing over me as though he was waiting for me to get up before hitting me again. I kicked him in the shin. He fell back, and I got to my feet. He was right on me again, and he swung. I went under it and intentionally caught him below the belt. He buckled over, grabbing at his nuts with both hands. I moved in, and he started swinging with the one arm to ward me off. I hit him twice, hard. He kept swinging one arm and the other hand holding onto his nuts. His face showed pain, but he would not stop. He would not go down. Those three or four generations of bricklaying genes, his hatred of the black-white blood in him, and his plain frustration with life would not let him go down. Thelma Claiborne and several others were in the barroom now, and Thelma had a broom. I felt the broom on my back, then I saw it flash in front of me as she swung it at the bricklayer. Then I was hitting something else, maybe the other bricklayer, maybe her husband, because I heard Claiborne saying, "God damn it, go find Vivian. Put that goddamn thing down, woman. Do like I say." I could hear all this, but I wasn't about to turn my head because the tall bricklayer was still on his feet. He was insane now, like a wounded animal in pain, and nothing could stop him. I kept moving back, maneuvering, so that I could land a good punch when he came in. I felt something heavy and soft behind me, and I glanced around at Thelma with that damn broom. The bricklayer hit me solidly on the arm, and down I went. I had never felt so much pain before, and I knew that there was no way I was going to get up, that I was going to die there. I was on my knees, and I was sure that the next feeling, my last, would be a shoe under my chin or in my side. I was waiting for it to happen the way a condemned man must wait that last hundredth of a second for the guillotine to fall. But it never did, because Thelma, with her broom, got between us. He was too much of a gentleman to knock her out of the way, or maybe he realized that such a thing would bar him from the place forever. Whatever it was, it gave me time to get to my feet. "Boxing is over," I said, and I grabbed a chair and threw it at him. He grabbed it and threw it back at me. I grabbed another one. Above all the noise those chairs were making, I could hear Claiborne, "Go find that woman. Schoolhouse. Children play in yard." He was saying all this between sounds of something hitting the wall, something like flesh and bone and a baseball cap turned backward. I was hearing this. I wasn't really seeing it, because the tall bricklayer still had a chair, and so did I, and Thelma had a broom, and it was hitting me on the head, the bricklayer on the shoulder, me in the side, the bricklayer in the chest. Claiborne and the fat boy fell down on the floor and scrambled back up, and I heard Claiborne, "Gusta, Gilly, y'all can't hear neither? Gusta, crank your old ass up and go find that woman. Gilly, find my gun. Won't listen to reason, they'll listen to lead." This was said between the thumping of flesh and bone and a baseball cap turned backwards, blows followed by groans, and Claiborne saying, "No, you ain't got enough yet." While the tall bricklayer and I kept trying to find an opening with those chairs so we could kill each other, I heard a solid, mean, crunching sound and a deep groan, followed by something heavy falling from the ceiling or pushed violently forward to the floor. I heard Claiborne screaming for the tall bricklayer and me to stop, and I heard Thelma plead, "Don't do it." That was the last thing I heard. After that, it was dark, completely dark. One moment, as I remember it, the bricklayer and I were circling each other with chairs. The next moment, absolute darkness. The darkness came at the exact moment as a blow to the side of my head. I could hear a voice before I knew who was talking or where I was. Then I began to think I knew the voice, but I wasn't sure. Then I began to know where I was, but I was not sure about that either. Then I began definitely to identify the voice, though still not sure where I was. Then I was able to see and feel, and I knew the voice, because she was down on the floor with me and holding my head in her lap. "He's all right," Vivian said. "Get him out of here," Claiborne said. "Are you all right?" Vivian asked. "Hi, honey," I said. "Are you all right?" Vivian asked. "I'm okay. Can you stand up?" I tried to nod my head. "Get him out of here," Claiborne said. "Are you all right, honey?" Vivian said. "I'm all right." "Get him out of here," Claiborne said. "I don't give a shit if he's all right or not. Before you know it, the law will be here. Get him out of here." "Can you stand up, honey?" Vivian asked again. "I can stand up." "Well, come on. Stand up for me, honey," Vivian said. "I can stand up," I said. "Damn it, I can stand up." "He can stand up," Vivian said. "See? He's standing up now. Come on, honey."
Chapter 26. What happened? Claiborne knocked you out. Why did Claiborne knock me out? You wouldn't stop fighting. Did he knock him out too? No. Well, why didn't he knock him out? He quit. Claiborne told him he would shoot his head off if he didn't, and he quit. You wouldn't. I didn't hear Claiborne say anything like that to me. That's what he told me. He said he knocked Griffin out first. You were the next one closest to him. He hollered at you to stop, kept hollering at you, and you went swinging that chair, so he just came up behind you and knocked you out. With that gun? That's all he had in his hand when I got there. Poor Mr. Gusta running up and down the street calling my name. Come stop you, come stop you. I'm sorry, honey. No, you're not sorry. I just couldn't help it. Yes, you could. I couldn't. You could have walked out of there. Can Jefferson walk out where he is? We were sitting on her bed. There were matching lamps and matching shades on either side of the bed. The shades were pink, with little white tassels. A chiffon robe was in the room, and there were a soft chair and dresser. I could see us, me and her, in the mirror above the dresser. I had a wet towel on top of my head, and my left hand was holding the towel in place. I didn't look too good. I felt even worse. Vivian sighed. "Well, I guess that's that," she said. "That's what, honey?" "You'll have to stay here tonight." "What for?" "Because you're in no condition to drive home." "I'm all right," I said. "I'll be all right in a minute. I'm calling Dora. Let her keep the children." "Don't do that, honey, please. She's kept them before. Honey, I don't want you in any trouble." "Well, you should have thought about that at the Rainbow Club," she said. "They were talking about Jefferson, honey. What would you have done?" "I would have walked out of there." "No, you would not. You would have said something." "Maybe that's what you should have done instead of swinging that chair." "Vivian, what about your marriage? What about the school? All they can do is fire me. Maybe he'll take the children. But you weren't thinking about that," she said. "I'm going to leave. I don't want to get you in any trouble." "I'm already in trouble. Mr. Gus running up and down the street calling my name. Come quick, come quick. And me leading you by the hand out of a barroom fight. What do you call that? I don't want you in any deeper trouble." I tried to stand up, but my head felt as if it would burst open, and I sat down on the bed again. "I'll leave in a few minutes," I said. "If I can't drive, I'll call somebody to take me home." "You're not going anywhere," she said. "I'm calling Dora to keep the children. I have some red beans and rice back there, a couple of fried pork chops." "I'm not hungry," I said. "Well, I am." "Don't be mad, honey." "I'm not mad, just disgusted." "I had to do it, honey, I had to. I just couldn't take it anymore." "That's how you get yourself killed." "I didn't start it." "Maybe you didn't, but you were ready." "It's been all that other stuff, the jail, the preacher, all of that." She got up from the bed. "I'm going to go warm the food," she said. "I'll be in the kitchen." "Don't be mad, honey, please." She didn't answer.
That's all the time we have for today's readings from Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them in our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. You can call us at 919-832-5138 or visit our website at triangleReadingService.org. I will repeat both of those at the end of this broadcast. Once again, I'm Kirk Benrood. Our readers, Tom Haynes, Pam Vesper, Robbie Merritt, Awen Fulton, and Dan and Julie Oliver, thank you for listening. The music was supplied by Joni Madden of the Irish-American band Cherish the Ladies. Our phone number once again is 919-832-5138. Our web address once again is triangleReadingService.org.